from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my special guest this evening Daryl Hamamoto, who's a professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Davis, and also hopefully joining us in the near future, Dave Gaheri, who is a reporter with American Free Press, who published an article recently and who has done interviews related to our topic this evening, which is the lawsuit by Professor James Tracy, now who has been removed from his tenured position against Florida Atlantic University for the abuse of their position. Daryl, I'm so happy to have you with me this evening.
Thank you, Jim, for the invitation. I'm glad to be here with you and your audience today.
We'll start with a little background. Chance, if you can show the first slide. This is an article that Dave Gaheri published about the lawsuit in American Free Press, where he has filed the suit against the university that fired him and the union that failed to defend him. It will turn out there's a very curious aspect to this, where the union was responsible for responding to a demand by the university within a 10-day interval, and the union simply abdicated that responsibility and failed to stand up for his rights, which has made them a target of this suit. The second slide is just one of hundreds of proofs we have that Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax. This is a particularly striking photograph for multiple reasons. We have discovered that the school was closed by 2008, and that there were no students there when a two-day FEMA drill was conducted on the 13th, a rehearsal going live on the 14th. We even have the manual, which I included in the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook 2015, which was banned by Amazon.com in less than a month after it had been made available to the public. On the 22nd of October, it was banned on 19 November after having sold nearly 500 copies. If you look here, you'll find confirmation that the school had been abandoned early on because it's not compliant with requirements of the American for Disability Act with regard to the blue and white painted parking areas and the blue and white signage. In the book, you'll find versions, copies of the Connecticut state law and the federal law responsible for that they had to adhere to if they were in compliance with the law. And the fact they're not in compliance with the law is a striking indication that this is because they were not an operating school. Notice, too, that although it was a 28-degree Fahrenheit day ground temperature, which meant the school would have had to have been heated to be functioning because the boilers had not been used since 2008. They were non-functional. And as a consequence, you can see no heat, no steam rising from the building. Now, that's because it was a cold school. It was impossible for them to have heated it. Notice, in addition, all the vehicles in the center rows are pointed facing the school. Observe the driving instructions coming in from Dickinson Drive would demand that you would turn right, curl around, and then park facing away from the school. But it was much simpler since they were simply loading the cars to serve as props in an elaborate instance of political theater. They simply brought them in a single file and filled them in two by two by two so that they're all facing the school. Notice, too, there's no indication here of any urgency, no indication of any surge of EMTs into the building, no string of ambulances. In fact, in other photographs you can see, Dickinson Drive is so clogged you could not have gotten an emergency vehicle in there if your life had depended upon it. Obviously, in this instance, no one's did, and therefore they were extremely casual about it. Dave, I'm so very pleased that you're able to join us. Dave Gaheri from American Free Press.
Welcome, thank you, Jim.
Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hello, and hello, Daryl. Good evening.
How are you doing, Dave?
The usual with Skype. Battling Skype.
Dave, no problem at all. We have already shown, but you can flip back, Chance, to the very first slide. We began with your story in American Free Press about a Florida professor who stands for free speech, which I think was an excellent summary. and was among many reasons I wanted to feature you here today with Daryl Hamamoto. Now, if we go forward to past the second slide to the third, I've published now three articles about major news outlets that have published propaganda about Sandy Hook. I don't just make that assertion. I actually prove it in each of these three blogs that were published on jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. The first of the three I published on January 7th, 2016, proof that the New York Times publishes Sandy Hook disinformation and propaganda. If you go there, you'll see how I was able to prove that the newspaper and its reporters knew better and were publishing false information in an effort to deceive the public. In the next slide, you'll see I also discovered that the Washington Post had joined the Sandy Hook propaganda game, which I published on 15 January 2016. And third, and perhaps in some ways more disturbing even than the other two, that the Chronicle of Higher Education, which most of us in academia, yeah, go ahead to the fifth slide, Chance, has also published a simply absurd account of what had happened here, about trashing James Tracy, accusing him as having stalked the family of Lenny Posner, when in fact the background for this was rather straightforward if you only bothered to study their exchanges. The Posners had been undermining websites of those who were studying the Sandy Hook event and producing evidence that it was a contrivance, that it was a fraud, that it was a two-day FEMA drill that was presented as a live event, where when Lenny Posner, who claims to be the father of Noah, one of the victims, filed a claim against James Tracy for the improper use of an image of his son Noah. And Chance, if you go back to the previous slide, number four, you'll see an image of Noah there at the bottom. Tracy wrote him to ask whether he could provide a warrant for his claim to have copyright on these images, because Noah is a very unusual little boy. Not only is he supposed to have died on 15 December 2012 in Sandy Hook during a shooting massacre that in fact did not take place, but again on 16 December 2016 in Pakistan. As though that weren't odd enough, during his 100 hours of conversation with Kelly Watt, who's been a very dedicated student of Sandy Hook, and who, because she has her own commercial and home cleaning service and knew that blood is a biohazard that has to be disposed of very carefully in accordance with strict procedures and extensive documentation, she began calling agencies in Connecticut to ask them who had cleaned up the blood. None of them could answer her question, and eventually they directed her to Lieutenant Paul Vance of the Connecticut State Police, who'd actually threatened to prosecute anyone who challenged the official account. And his response when she asked him who cleaned up the blood was classic, to wit, what blood? I think it didn't occur to him because, of course, it wasn't any blood, because the whole event was a fabrication, which is also the reason why those involved in the destruction of the school were required to sign lifetime gag orders against ever addressing or speaking about anything they saw or did not see, which I'm convinced would have included the absence of pockmarks in the walls from bullets having been fired and the absence of any blood on the ground. If you go back now to the next slide, number five. The Chronicle also ignores the fact that when Kelly Watt asked Lenny Posner for a copy of Noah's death certificate, he sent her a copy of a death certificate that proved to be a fraud. I published it on page 181 of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, where the bottom is the photocopy of an actual death certificate, but the top is completely fraudulent. It has no official file number, which is already telling enough. It also gives an estimated time of death at 11 a.m., but all the shooting took place around 9:35 to 9:40 or so, where we have been able to prove it's a fraud. Now, obviously, if Noah had actually died, it would have been unnecessary for Lenny to fake a death certificate, which he had to do because he didn't have a real one. And where the Chronicle has claimed that Tracy was stalking Lenny Posner and his wife Veronique when he simply was trying to determine whether they could justify their claim to copyright, they basically turned the story inside out as another form of propaganda. If we look at the next slide, we see a report published now, and I believe this came from his website, about James Tracy filing a civil rights lawsuit against Florida Atlantic University and the faculty union, that they threatened faculty due process and free speech throughout the United States, which is unquestionably the case. And just for background, I'll read this one passage from his attorney, Louis Leo IV. Tenure, free speech, due process, and academic freedom are under attack. Without judicial interventions, employees and faculty at Florida Atlantic University and other universities around the United States will continue to be censored, deterred, and chilled from sharing unpopular information or opinions for fear that they will be disciplined on a pretext. And in fact, I must say, Daryl, you may or may not be aware, but we've just had a weakening of the tenure policies here at the University of Wisconsin, which has shocked the faculty. They've been protesting, and because they're most unhappy with this weakening of what has been an historic tradition in the University of Wisconsin system, even the governor, Scott Walker, has been attacking them for their presumption to an entitlement of lifetime employment. When that isn't the issue, what they're talking about is they're being made vulnerable in relation to addressing controversial and complex issues, just as happened in the case of James Tracy. I'm sure you have found this and other developments of a similar kind to be profoundly disturbing.
I've been following the situation at the University of Wisconsin primarily through a blog called Remaking the University. I recommend it for your viewers if they want to get a general grasp of the issues that affect us in academia. I'm really interested in what is behind this. It seems like a universal move against professional intellectuals, troublemakers, dissidents in the academy. The end game is the abolition of tenure. You can see that they're spinning it as an issue of lifetime employment. No, not really, because the minority of faculty these days are tenured faculty. Most of them are contingent laborers. They're day laborers, in a manner of speaking, that go from job to job. They're lecturers. That's the true composition of the workforce in the university. But of that subset, that last remaining perhaps 20-30% of tenured faculty, I'm talking about nationally now, I'd say at least half of them are truly not doing any work or trying to, coast and slide through as best as they can. But then there are people like James Tracy who are doing cutting edge work. People like yourself who are the most productive, doing the most incisive, thought provoking work that the university used to enable us to do. And these are the people that are being targeted. So I see James Tracy as being one of the first cases in a series of targeted removals of professors, and eventually, of course, when our ranks are weakened sufficiently enough, they'll just take away the entire tenure system. And one of the reasons for the urgency of this is not just for the ideas that we're putting forth, but also the fact is that there's been a long-standing attempt to try to get at this huge union, these pension funds, the retirement funds, rather, that Wall Street and their criminal associates have been licking their chops trying to get a hold of. So when that happens, of course, the faculty is not going to be very happy, and they're going to be very public about it. But in order to execute that huge, super grand theft, you're going to have to eliminate all the sources of intellectual leadership, such as Professor James Tracy, before they go in for the kill.
I think those are very discerning observations, Darrell, which I greatly appreciate. I do suspect weakening tenure is another way of silencing those outspoken members of the academy who actually understand the purpose for which tenure was created. I actually was appreciated for my research on JFK while I was on the Duluth campus of the University of Minnesota. I believe it may have been fortuitous because there was a associate dean of the graduate school on the Twin Cities campus who loved my work. He was fascinated by JFK and the fact that I brought together the best qualified individuals to ever study the case was something that he greatly appreciated. In fact, the University of Minnesota even financed my organizing a national conference on the Twin Cities campus in 1999, where I brought in 20 or more experts on different aspects of the case, and a subsequent conference that I organized on the Duluth campus in 2003 that was focused on the Zapruder film specifically. But when I published my books on the assassination, beginning with Assassination Science in 1998, which exposed that the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout at the back of the head, that a 6.5 millimeter metallic slice had been added to the anterior posterior x-ray, that the wound to the neck initially was just a small clean puncture wound for which I had diagrams from a physician who had been present in trauma room number one and 2 days later was responsible for the treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald. I received only support and praise from the university, for which I'm enormously grateful. And then when I published the successor murder in Dealey Plaza in 2000 and eventually the great Zapruder film hoax in 2003, I was never criticized by the university. On the other hand, in December of 2005, just 6 months before my retirement in June of 2006, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And I'm not at all sure that the university would have continued to be as supportive as they had in relation to my research on JFK, because I was dealing with such a more nearly contemporaneous issue of enormous significance. David, I'm very eager to get your reflections on the James Tracy case. You've interviewed him. You published this and other articles about it. In my opinion, you've been doing superb work, and I'm extremely impressed that American Free Press has been covering this because virtually no one else has been doing so. At least they haven't been doing so adequately, where Tracy was subjected to propagandistic attacks by Lenny Posner that was published in the South Florida Sun Sentinel, in the Jewish Journal Forward, and in the Miami Herald. I mean, it was embarrassing that they were publishing so much provably false claims about James Tracy, his research, and its significance.
Yes, one of the advantages of reading lawsuits thoroughly is that it gives you a lot more information than you would get from an article in the mainstream media. And what became very clear to me when I read the lawsuit was the coordinated attack on Professor Tracy by not just the school, but the mainstream media, almost like they worked hand in hand to get the job done from the very beginning. I think it was just 3 weeks after he had voiced or penned his views about Sandy Hook that the attack began. And to me, at least, seeing that that coordinated assault in the time that it was done and the way that it was done is evidence that these organizations work hand in hand. And I think there's a lot that we really don't know that's going on behind the scenes. And I think that the James Tracy matter really speaks to a much larger picture here, a much larger trend in the country. And Jim, we've spoken about this, about academic freedom, what has happened to it. When I was in college, you were rewarded for thinking differently, for challenging. It seems like that's all going away. And I'm afraid that, like Daryl said, this is just the beginning of the final assault on freedom in academia.
Well, you know, it's rather stunning to me that these reports from the New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Chronicle of Higher Education about Sandy Hook are so shoddy and ill-informed, if not deliberately deceptive. And yet, just before I came down to join you for this conversation tonight, I was listening to Chris Matthews interview a woman who represented Scientific American about Hillary Clinton, implying that she's going to release information about unidentified flying objects and ETs if she becomes president. And Chris Matthews, who it turns out really is not a very knowledgeable fellow on quite a surprisingly wide range of topics, appears to have no understanding of the depth of research that's been done on this area. He allowed this representative of Scientific American just to give the most flimsy dismissals that there's nothing to it, we've looked into it, where Chris Matthews was congratulating her on the clarity of her thought, her logic, and reliance on the scientific method, when nothing could be more opposite than the case. I'm no expert on the Disclosure Project or UFOs, but I have probably 15 books that are heavy books of serious research on the subject, which I've not myself been in a position to pursue because my I'm dealing with so many other issues. But the fact is, he also said during this interview, which just occurred, that he has people who come up to tell him that someone other than Lee Oswald shot JFK, and they also want to know about UFOs, or others who suggest similarly for Bobby. And this is conclusive proof that he has no idea what he's talking about. JFK was hit 4 different times. He was hit in the back from behind, 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column. He was hit in the throat by a shot that actually passed through the windshield, which Dr. Charles Crenshaw drew for me, that small puncture wound. Then after the driver, William Greer, pulled the limousine to a halt, he was hit twice in the head, once from behind by a shot fired from the Dow taxi, slumped forward. Jackie eased him up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium to the left rear with such force that when they impacted with Officer Bobby Hargis, who was riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. And the case of Bobby is even more obvious to anyone who spends any time on it whatsoever, because Thomas Noguchi, a world-famous medical examiner for Los Angeles County, performed a completely competent autopsy and determined that Bobby had been shot 4 times from behind, 3 times in the back and once behind the right ear from a distance of about 1.5 inches. Anyone who knows the least about Sirhan knows he was never behind Bobby. He only fired from in front. He never got closer than, say, 1.5 feet or more to Bobby himself, didn't hit him with any of his shots. And it's just an outrage to me that a person like Chris Matthews, and there are quite a few others I encounter in the major media, are willing to offer what they, you know, come across as definitive pronouncements when they know nothing at all about the case. So in some ways, it's not surprising about Sandy Hook. And yet it's such a dereliction of duty. I don't know when I've been more profoundly disturbed by the abdication of responsibility of the Fourth Estate. Thomas Jefferson was once asked whether he'd prefer a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government. And he said he'd prefer the latter to the former, but I don't believe he ever contemplated that the state of the news reporting could be so totally ignorant and corrupt. Daryl.
Well, the good news is that not very many people are watching Microsoft NBC. That's what the MS stands for. Right. Very few people even consider Chris Matthews and all of them legitimate reporters. I think the surge of independent media programs such as this, or at a really, really large scale, the Alex Jones Show, Caravan of Midnight, independent outlets like this have rendered those particular corporate controlled and owned propaganda machines, right? This is a Mockingbird Media 2.0. It makes the Kennedy era Mockingbird Media look amateurish. It's discredited. And perhaps because they're feeling that they're losing grip on the control of the American mind and perceptions and information base, maybe that's why they're so desperate to engage in these types of scenarios, these drills or these campaigns, including the Boston bombing, Sandy Hook, and a host of other suspect scenarios that we've seen unfold over the past few years, that they're very, very desperate. They're a wounded animal, and wounded animals really are quite, quite dangerous. And Matthews, all these other people, in time, they will be revealed primarily as corporate shills as opposed to journalists. The only person in this conversation that's concerned about journalism, as we were taught to understand it, is Professor James Tracy, professor of journalism. He's imparting really important values as well as techniques to his students, ones of honesty, sourcing, inquiry, right? He made a legitimate journalistic inquiry of Lenny Posner, whoever that is. And there's very little evidence that there is such a person called Lenny Posner to begin with, right? But he did his due diligence in trying to find out the provenance of that photograph of so-called Noah Posner. He was doing his job as a professor of journalism and as a professional journalist. And look what's happened. The mainstream corporate horror media has combined forces with these other entities to target Professor James Tracy and others to follow soon, to silence people, to put them out of business and to scare the bejesus out of their colleagues, the professoriate, which in general, they're not well known for their courage to begin with, but now they're very scared and they're holding on for dear life for their jobs. Because as I told you at the outset, the tenure system is almost done away with anyway. About one third of the faculty is tenure track or tenured. So that's where Tracy comes into the situation. Just on a personal note, I just talked to him probably about an hour and a half ago. And ladies and gentlemen, Professor James Tracy is in very good spirits. He's a fighter. He's a champion of truth. He's not going to give up. He's not going to cave in like his colleagues. So these people, whoever's behind Posner, Lenny Posner, quote unquote Lenny Posner, because he's a spook, I guess. He's a cutout. He's a phantom. Whoever's behind him is going to be in for a rude revelation about the power of the truth.
Well, I too have been very impressed with the thorough and detailed character of the lawsuit. It seemed to me to be an exemplary document that the author knew his stuff. He appears to be an extremely competent attorney. And I believe that James has a rock solid case against the university and the union, to which we shall turn. But before doing so, I want to invite Dave Gaheri, who spent so much of his life as a journalist in the newspaper business, interviewing key figures in relation to issues that are complex and controversial, where his association with American Free Press, it seems to me, has exemplified the highest traditions of American journalism. Dave, I'd like you to comment on how you have reacted to this firing of James Tracy, this abuse of the authority of the academy, and his taking steps to set things right.
Yes, well, I remember when I first interviewed Dr. Tracy, and this was, Jim, you introduced me to a lot of these folks that have something to do with Sandy Hook. And I interviewed Dr. Tracy, and I was really impressed, and I told you this, Jim. I was really impressed with him as an academician, as a human being. He was, like Daryl said, he was doing his job, and that's all he could do. And one thing that really stood out to me in that interview, and I put it in this latest article that you referenced, is that when he explained to me why the course he taught was so vital. And I wrote, in my opinion, to the survival of a free and prosperous country. He said, I wouldn't be involved in studying the media and commenting on it and critiquing it if I were not able to talk about the political element of it. Because all media, especially news media, are political by their very nature. Now that might seem like common sense to you and to Daryl and to the audience and to a lot of other folks, but that's what concerns me. That's what worries me, is that something as simple as this, that the news media is political by its very nature, is just shunted aside. And it seems in a monolithic fashion, as I mentioned before, whatever this complex is, the media government complex, they're aligned right now and they're on the same page and they're fighting hard to make sure that alternative views like James Tracy's, like yours, Jim, or yours, Daryl, are shut down. And unfortunately, it seems like a lot of the populace is behind them, unfortunately. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. I'm really disheartened by the lawsuit. I'm heartened by the lawsuit, and I agree with you. I think that something very positive is going to come out of it. I know myself, I was involved in a high profile lawsuit. The New York Stock Exchange sued me to shut me up because I was critical of them. And it was in a district court in Manhattan in the Southern District of New York, and it went on for about 2 years. And it turned out that I was triumphant. Of course, it was a Pyrrhic victory, but I won based on First Amendment, based on the First Amendment. And these entities, like the New York Stock Exchange, like FAU, like any of these entities that cannot stomach an alternative view, they will do whatever they can to shut it down, and they have the resources to do it. Fortunately, I was able to prevail, and I didn't get anything out of it, but it's there for everybody to see. I beat the New York Stock Exchange because I believed in the First Amendment. And I told my lawyer that, no, I'm not going to agree to anything. This is America. I can do what I want. And I did it all the way to the end. And Robert Carter, who recently passed on, he was the judge who ruled. He was one of the lawyers that argued in front of the Supreme Court in the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling. He ruled in my favor in a 30-page opinion. So I'm upset, I'm concerned about the state of affairs, I have a certain amount of confidence in the justice system as it applies to the Constitution. So I think that Dr. Tracy is going to prevail. And I really hope that, because he's such a nice guy, and like Daryl was saying earlier, the father of four young kids, what a, just a terrific guy. Nobody deserves this, especially somebody like him. And I hope we can get together when he is, when he's successful in his lawsuit.
Well, I agree with everything you're saying here. I mean, no one who knows the history of Professor Tracy's contributions as an academician and the significance of the areas he investigates, such as including the media and conspiracy. That's one of his designated areas of expertise on which he offers courses and conducts research. When you have such a mild-mannered, even-tempered, clearly intelligent and judicious individual as James Tracy, to me, it reflects the manifest absurdity of these suits, where it ought not to have been a challenge to the resources of institutions such as the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Chronicle of Higher Education to have determined that Noah Foster had been reported to have died twice, once at Sandy Hook and once in Pakistan 2 years later, that Lenny Posner had provided a provably fabricated death certificate which were the kinds of concerns that led James Tracy to inquire whether he had a bona fide claim to a copyright for photographs where he was asserting it without having justified his assertion, and where James Tracy was performing an act that is technically known as one of supererogation by going beyond the call of duty or the requirements of ordinary morality by seeking to protect the public from scams and hoaxes where it turns out that sympathetic but gullible Americans have contributed between $27 and $130 million to the families of the alleged victims, where in fact we have proven that nobody died in Sandy Hook. There were no victims. So they pocketed over $1 million apiece for playing their role in an elaborate scenario where we know that Eric Holder and Barack Obama were very much involved in the planning, as well as the governor of Connecticut, the Connecticut State Police, the Newtown Police Department, the fire department, and even the members of the school board, who, of course, knew that the school was loaded with asbestos and biohazards, had been severely damaged by hurricanes. That when Wolfgang Halbig and I visited Newtown in order to meet with the members of the school board at their regularly scheduled meeting, where we had 3 minutes to make statements to the members of the board, I asked the school board at the time, when were the parents notified that their children were attending school in a toxic waste dump? The fact is that back in 2007 and 2008, when they had to make the decision of whether to overhaul the school, make it wheelchair accessible, upgrade it to the standards of the Americans with Disability Act, and declined to do so being not cost effective, they began using the school for storage. It's full of all kinds of furniture, all kinds of boxes of miscellaneous stuff. In some of the purported classrooms, the furniture is pushed up right against the wall, right against the windows. I mean, it's completely outrageous. And the fact is that these august institutions have done no research whatsoever. In my opinion, their irresponsibility is simply appalling. Their failure to perform any due diligence with respect to what they're publishing means they're no better than another organ parroting the official position of the government as a mechanism, a machine of disinformation.
Yeah, I think it's important what you mentioned, because I was there in Sandy Hook with you and Wolfgang covering it for American Free Press. And we spent quite a bit of time in different areas of the town. And one of the things I came away with was how odd the town was. The feeling I got there, hanging out in front of the firehouse and looking at the lay of the land and imagining why in God's green earth, if children are coming from a school in the back of the firehouse, why would they walk on a sidewalk-less street, a busy street going uphill to stop at the house of one Gene Rosen when they most likely, common sense-wise, would have just easily congregated in front of the firehouse. Children associate firemen with police, with safety. So even that one item about Sandy Hook made me think that something's not right. And the reception that we got, actually, I even was threatened a little bit by someone, one of the residents there. I don't know if you were aware of that, Jim, but that was during that Board of Education meeting that you referenced before. These people were just odd, just very strange. And that really added a lot to my understanding of Sandy Hook, where someone could read about it, but if they're there, and they actually witnessed how these residents are, if in fact they were residents at all, I don't know. And coupled with the way that they expect people to believe the children traveled from the school, it's just nonsensical.
Your points about Gene Rosen are very well taken. It turns out that he actually had given lectures on gun control for FEMA before the Sandy Hook event. He claimed that a bus came by and dropped off five of these students at his home, that he brought them into his house and gave them cookies and played with stuffed animals, orange juice, until they started talking about it. But this is absurd. I think his scenario was supposed to introduce the idea that buses had been used to evacuate the students, of whom there should have been 469. But when we look at the locations in the parking lot and the times where the police claim evacuation was taking place, there's no one there. And while it's often said that you can't prove a negative, you can prove there's no elephant in your living room by going to your living room and looking for the signs of the presence of elephant, none being there. You're entitled to infer the negative that there is no elephant in your living room. If you go to the locations and times where 469 students were allegedly being evacuated and you find there's no one there, you're entitled to infer that's because no evacuation was taking place. And further, with regard to Gene Rosen, he's simply incredible. Why would any bus driver drop children off at the home of someone who is neither their parent nor their custodian? His story won't withstand the most flimsy scrutiny. It's a manifest absurdity, and it's embarrassing that they used persons of this low quality and stories that were this fantastic, literally unbelievable, to promote the Sandy Hook hoax. I want to turn to one more slide, number 7, because it seems to me it's the core of the case that the university used a very vague statement about conflict of interest against James Tracy, where it's so vague that when he was asked to declare that whether his work was or was not in conflict of interest with the university's policies, he could not answer the question. Let me just read these paragraphs, and then I want to invite Daryl's comment. Conflict of interest. Outside activity is defined as private practice, private consulting, additional teaching or research for someone or an entity that is not FAU, or other professional activity, compensated or uncompensated, which is not part of the faculty member's assigned duties and for which the university has provided no compensation. Point 121. The defendant university's November 2015 explanation also provided that conflict of interest is defined as any conflict between the private interests of the employee and that employee's obligations to FAU, the public interests of FAU, or the interests of the state of Florida. This includes conflicts of interest specified under Florida statutes, Section 112.313, federal regulations, or university policy. CFAU's report of outside employment available online or from human resources. It also includes any activity that interferes with the full performance of the employee's professional or institutional responsibilities or work obligations. Now, the outside activity that James was engaged in was a blog, memoryholeblog.com, where he was discussing issues of current concern to the public, especially in this case in relation to Sandy Hook. Now, how could anyone possibly determine whether those activities were or were not consistent with the public interests of FAU when the public interests of FAU are not otherwise specified? If one presumes that the public interests of FAU include promoting responsible research, discovering the truth, and advancing public understanding and complex interests, then there's no question whatsoever that his blog activities were not in conflict with the public interests of FAU. Alternatively, if the public interests of FAU include closing off, suppressing, or discouraging research on complex issues, no matter how significant for the general public, then without any question, what he was doing was in conflict with the public interests of FAU. But absence of specification and detail, this is unconstitutionally vague. You can't possibly use a statement like this to fault James Tracy when there's a very reasonable interpretation of its meaning with respect to which his activities were utterly consistent, even exemplary, but an alternative interpretation under which his activities would be viewed with disdain by the institution And who knows what the interests of the state of Florida. To me, this is the key, the crux of the issue, Daryl.
The way the university operates, and I know this from personal experience, is that all these different abstraction or these ideals that are written into the policies and procedures manual, or in my case, the APM, the Academic Personnel Manual, they are picked almost willy-nilly and random. The real crux of the matter is that Jim Tracy is revealing some unpleasant truths, and he's also raising some questions that could potentially blow the lid on huge intelligence operation in the United States of America being conducted by foreign entities. The same way with me, the administration does not want me probing into the role of Monsanto and other corporations in promoting genetically modified crops and organisms. They draw a lot of money from funders like that, or my public criticism of big pharma. But no, are they going to attack me on that? No, they will say, looking at the academic personnel manual, that I have am in violation of certain little rules and regulations that they set up arbitrarily. Now, one of them is as ludicrous as saying that I was using the wrong gender pronouns in my lectures. See how that works? That's all part of this. It includes the social justice warrior agenda. They'll take something from the GLBTQ or some other aggrieved minority group, write it into the APM. And if you are a troublemaker on a political level, on a corporate level, then they will selectively pick something out and try to hang you with that. It's not going to work because there's something called the United States Constitution. We're getting into black letter law here, getting into constitutional law. We're getting into civil rights and civil liberties. And so far, these characters have not been able to trump this reality, this bedrock of our freedoms here in the United States of America. Now, that might change because there's a chilling effect that was caused by the mysterious death of Judge Antonin Scalia down in South Texas. I think that's a strong message saying that, listen, the courts belong to us as well. In cases that go forward and are argued at the Supreme Court level, perhaps, of the United States, vertically.
And commenting backwards,
I was unfamiliar with their case.
The death of Scalia be very, very troubling indeed. He was lacking security. It was in a remote region. No autopsy was performed. The disposition of the body happened with preternatural speed. What you're describing about your own campus sounds like political correctness on steroids. It's well known that Monsanto is producing genetically modified products that have serious adverse effects. For example, they have added an insecticide gene to their corn genome, which has yielded a larger take of crops from the field. But when it's fed to laboratory mice, it turns out they become sterile within 6 months. And Daryl, as you're no doubt aware, under the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Barack Obama has been promoting, countries will be unable to protest because food won't be allowed to be identified as genetically modified or not. And indeed, the TPP will create a board of corporate attorneys who have the right to override the laws and statute of any nation, subsumed thereby up to and including the Constitution of the United States. The U.S. will no longer be a sovereign nation once we have ratified the TPP. An incidental aspect of the agreement that the President of the United States has somehow overlooked informing the American public.
Correct. All that we're experiencing right now, observing in the case of James Tracy, myself, and many other people, this is a run-up to this larger New World Order consolidation, right? The fusing of all these different economic zones into one supranational government in which, as you've already alluded to, national sovereignty becomes thrown out the window. It no longer exists.
Right. Just further confirmation, John Kerry gave the graduation address at Northeastern University, and explain everyone should become familiar and comfortable with the concept of a borderless world, because part and parcel of this is to create these supranational entities like the European Union. At one point, there was a proposal for a North American Union that would merge Canada, the United States, and Mexico, where travel would require no passports, no interaction, as is true in the European Union today, where the sovereignty of the individual nations that have, in many cases, distinct, unique histories has been subsumed, and where now they're being overwhelmed by massive migrant immigration, which is completely contrary, a form of cultural invasion and warfare, in my judgment. This is all appalling, but it looks as though it's a sort of thing that John Kerry and Barack Obama are promoting for the United States of America, and where I believe it's one reason why the public has been responsive in a positive way to the Republican candidate's proposal for a temporary ban on immigration by Muslims into the United States until we can figure out what's going on. He might have been more tactful to define it in terms of region, the Middle East, than religion, Muslim, but I think the people understand what he was doing, what he was driving at, and support him. Dave, I'd welcome your further reflections.
Yes, I just wanted to introduce this point about the Tracy matter, that it also has to do with money. FAU is not doing well, and Tracy isn't helping with that. And so I think that some of it has to do with the fact that FAU needs the money. They're ranked very low in the state. They're obviously a public college, and it's all about money. So that is an element that I failed to address that in the article, but I just wanted to bring that up here.
Oh, Dave, when you say he's not helping them with respect to money, you mean they have wealthy donors who are upset by the fact that there's a member of the faculty who is addressing these complex issues, which they prefer not be addressed. And for that reason, they're withholding their funds in support of the university. And for that reason, the institution has a financial motive as well to discharge James Tracy to regain the support of their donors, presently withholding until something is done about him.
Exactly. Of course. It's financial blackmail. They do it all the time. They just did it to the those billboards about the USS Liberty, which simply said, "Honor Liberty Vets attacked by Israel." And there's nothing controversial about that. It was attacked by Israel. But this is the way that the financial world is. This is the way that leverage is put forth. And I wanted to mention, we were talking about the mainstream media before. I know that you guys saw that story about this Ben Rhodes fella.
Yeah.
One of Obama's top advisors.
Reports about the Iran nuclear agreement.
Right. But what was very significant, one of the things he said was, he was talking about the White House press corps. He said, and this is a quote, "The average reporter we talked to is 27 years old. And their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. That's a sea change. They literally know nothing."
He actually said that, yes.
Yeah, they literally know nothing. I think that really illustrates the frustration that all of us probably feel when we look at the mainstream media and we realize that they do move in unison and it is monolithic and they do know nothing. And you wonder, was it always like this? Was the country always like this? Was it really any better before, or are we just fooling ourselves? That's a question that I have yet to answer.
Well, because as Daryl's observed about the internet and alternative modes of communication and sources of information, it may be we know more about what's going on behind closed doors than was true in the past. Daryl?
Well, the social media, internet, from what I can tell, just talking to my students, not just in class observing them, but having focus groups, is that they've lost any sort of ability to critically reflect on almost any aspect of the world, society, and themselves, let alone the topics, the subjects that they're studying. There's been, and this has been talked about in other contexts as well, but there's been a general de-skilling of intellectual work in general. And we know that for most of the students who are not in science, technology, engineering, and math, there's no future. There's nothing. There's a jobless economy. And that's another source of the desperation that the handlers of the world economy have to figure out. What are they going to do with these individuals? So they'll send someone like John Skull and Bones Forbes Carey to the university to give a commencement speech and talk about the borderless economy, meaning, hey, ladies and gentlemen, look forward to competing with slave labor in China or India or some other country, intellectual labor, even if you're computer programming. So he's promoting a worldview, but he's also taunting the students by going right into their institution and saying, you have no future. This is a borderless economy, which, by the way, it's a concept. Well, it's an ancient concept, but it's really been promoted in the post-war period. And now it's reaching its terminal stage if we're not careful. And I'm an educator. I'm in the university. Those are the people I'm trying to reach. But from what I'm seeing, it's not happening there. And I'm trying to figure out how we can put together programming such as this that's going to reach the 25 to 40, 45-year-old people. When, you know, after their frontal lobe is fully developed into adulthood, they start thinking about serious issues. That's one area that independent media is sorely lacking in, and that's a demand that I hope to fill personally with my own program that's going to be focused on young people, the ones that are given the propaganda by their university professors about the borderless economy, the borderless world, sin fronteras, right, without frontiers, the we are the world concept, the one world concept, because most of them have bought into it, I'm afraid.
Well, based upon my knowledge of this case, the very thorough, detailed, and comprehensive and competent lawsuit in this instance, I believe it may turn out to backfire, just as banning the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook backfired when I immediately released it to the public as a PDF. I might have anticipated having 4,000 to 8,000 sales of the book, but now friends who have been following this have noticed there have been millions of people out there seeking to download it. Now that the public is by and large overwhelmingly better informed and have put us in the position now that we've obtained a new publisher and so forth to make the book available too as a bound volume at moonrockofbooks.com, where we've been able to contribute $5,000 to the legal defense of James Tracy. I want to thank you, Daryl, and you, Dave, for being here and making extremely valuable contributions to the discussion and understanding of the James Tracy lawsuit and of its importance and significance in the broader academic and intellectual context. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, thanking you for being here. Stand by for the second hour of the new JFK show.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people. people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research. And we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel. And we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy, and we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Jim and... This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where we're going to be discussing about the Rafael Cruz development with Ralph Sinkay, who's made real contributions to what's going on here. We're getting our slide set straight. Gary, Larry, would you like to say a few words of background? Gary.
Well, I welcome everyone to the new JFK show, number 102. We've been on the cutting edge with all this, and Larry Rivera and Ralph Sinkay have basically gone into the big time. They've made a difference in the presidential campaign. I mean, how big is that? So I'm just more than impressed about it. We've got a couple of pictures we're going to try to get in here. But Ralph, even though Wayne Mattson did break the story, it was Ralph Sinkay that went in and found other images of Rafael Cruz in Dealey Plaza. Wow. So you can't make this stuff up. So...
Larry, we can begin with this. We could begin with this old slide set while Chance is uploading the new one.
Okay.
No, Jim, I don't know if you're aware, but Wayne Mattson did an interview just the other day, and he talked about the whole thing and everything that happened, and he made what I think is a very important point, and that is that even if we didn't have any images, just from what we know about where Rafael Cruz was, what he was doing, and who he was involved with, he needs to answer as to whether he knew Oswald and whether he was involved in this, because he was definitely in New Orleans. He was definitely active in the whole Cuban dissident community. He definitely had CIA connections, and he has definitely avoided answering anything about how he was living at that time. For instance, he eventually started working for a company called Geocom, which is a CIA-connected company, but officially he didn't start there until 1966. So what exactly was he doing for income in 1963? He had a family. He wasn't divorced from his wife yet. They were, in other words, a husband, a wife, two kids living together and having to pay the bills. How was he doing it? So he has a lot of questions to answer, even if we didn't have these very compelling images of him.
Are you talking about when Wayne was on with Alex Jones doing an interview?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. That's what Wayne was saying. That look, regardless of what anybody thinks about the veracity of the images, Cruz has got, you know, some answering to do.
No, the point I make is this. Alex Jones has a big platform. And when you have someone with the kind of knowledge possessed by Wayne Mattson, it makes a powerful combination, because then you have very accurate and important information being disseminated by a very wide audience, large audience mechanism.
Well, what just happened with all this, Jim, is, in my opinion, historic, because what it is that the alternative media basically forced the mainstream media to address the story and to treat it as news. They certainly didn't want to. They wouldn't have done it voluntarily, but because of all the pressure and because of the way it was expanding virally all over the internet, they basically had to. And I'm looking at this very positively, because I think the same thing could happen with other issues and with a lot of the things that we say in the OIC about Oswald, that it could grow the same.
We'll talk about the old slide set, but Larry, could you send to Chance the new slide set? He doesn't. Could you resend it? Because he doesn't know that he's got it. He's asking if it could be resent.
I sent everybody.
I'll tell you what. Let me quickly try to do it myself.
All right. Meanwhile, let's go to the next slide, Chance. Let's go to the next. Go to the next slide, number two. This, of course, is historic for so many reasons. It's Lee Oswald outside of the trademark, which, of course, was run by Clay Shaw. Anyone who's ever seen Oliver Stone's magisterial JFK knows that Jim Garrison was prosecuting Clay Shaw for involvement in the assassination of JFK. He almost certainly would have prevailed in court, but for the unexpected death of three key witnesses who were unquestionably silenced to make sure they would never appear in court. On the very left, you see an image of someone cropped here. Typically, we have more of the image enough to identify this as Michael Payne, who was the husband of Ruth Payne, both associated with the CIA, where Ruth Payne arranged for Lee Oswald to have a position at the Texas School Book Depository and begin work there just 2 weeks before the motorcade would travel past that location. In the middle, of course, we have Rafael Cruz, and incidentally, Lee's girlfriend in Dallas at the time, Judith Berry Baker, whose name was Judith Avery, who was involved in research to develop a rapid-acting cancer vaccine with David Ferry and Lee Oswald under the supervision of Dr. Mary Sherman, so they joke about their names, Mary, Ferry, and Berry, has identified Rafael Cruz as someone that she had actually met in New Orleans with Lee. And on the far right, the shorter figure is somebody I knew personally, Chauncey Marvin Holt. He was a counterfeiter, a forger, an artist who was working as a contract agent for the CIA when he was directed by his handler, Philip Twombly, to prepare 15 sets of Foreign Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. When he arrived there to deliver them, he was supposed to leave them in a red pickup truck that was in the parking lot behind the grassy knoll, which was used by the Dallas Police Department, but it wasn't there. He wandered around Dealey Plaza, and he told me he saw more bad guys, mercenaries, and assassins than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. He returned to the location. The vehicle was there. He left the documents, and in the company of Charles Harrelson and someone he knew as Richard Montoya, but who was in fact Richard Rogers, they headed down to the railroad yard behind the parking area where a boxcar would appear to be unlocked, but they were to enter it, and they found when they climbed in, it was loaded with ammunition, weapons, and explosives. They would subsequently be apprehended by the police and walk through Dealey Plaza.
Excuse me, Jim, let me have that email address again, please.
Say again?
Give me the email address for Chance.
George@webookyourshow.com.
Okay. Thank you.
We're being escorted through Dealey Plaza. They were in the order of Charles Rogers in the front, very spiffily dressed, certainly didn't look like a hobo or a tramp. Charles Harrelson, the tallest of the three, who was a hitman for the mob and the father of actor Woody Harrelson. And then the third, although often confused with E. Howard Hunt, was Chauncey Marvin Holt. I'm convinced that had Oswald not worked out as the patsy, that they would have been the fallback because of the presence of the explosives, weapons, and ammunition in the railway car. But if we go to the next slide, this is one of the photographs we have to compare the image we find in the trademark photograph. And Larry, why don't you pick up and make some comments here, because you've done a lot with the photo comparison.
This is actually the man in the trademark next to Lee Oswald, and the one on the right is a ladder photograph of Refno Cruz, and I believe we've done a couple of overlays on these, like I said before, they weren't really, really conclusive, but they were close enough where further study would have been necessary.
Right.
Well, if you go to the next slide, we have the Hands Off Cuba, the Fair Play for Cuba, a brochure that Lee Oswald was handing out when they were seeking to give him the persona of a pro-Castro communist sympathizer. Chauncey Marvin Holt, by the way, said that everyone in that photograph was involved in Operation Mongoose. And, of course, we know that Rafael Cruz was in New Orleans at the time. We know he'd left Cuba about 2 years before Castro had come to power, but that he was fervently anti-Castro. And it astonished me, Ralph, that you found in the next photograph in slide number 5 that Rafael Cruz was also captured in Dallas on 22 November 1963 in a very famous photograph taken by a Dallas Morning News photographer. And, Ralph, you may or may not know, but this was on the cover of my first book on JFK assassination science. It's Rafael Cruz.
I seem to recall that now. Let me say something about this, Jim. I think the location is extremely important. It's taken on Main Street, and he is obviously on the south side of Main Street. And it's pretty close to Houston Street. I don't know how far down, but less than a block. So he's basically at the entrance of Dealey Plaza. And from that position where he is, after the limo passed him, he was positioned very well that all he had to do was walk to the corner where, and then cross Houston Street, and he would have had a direct view of the kill zone. Now, keep in mind that if he was on the other side of the street, it would have been more difficult, because if he went to Houston, the motorcade would have been turning that direction on Houston. And I doubt that the police wanted any, you know, spectators, you know, dodging in between the cars of the motorcade. But since they weren't turning left, that meant that where he was standing right there, all he had to do was walk to the end of the block, cross the street, and then he would have been viewing the kill zone. Now, let's consider something, Jim. And I want you to know that I already resent the photos to George, so he should have them right now, and hopefully he's going to be able to put them up. But I want to point out that the motorcade was about 10 miles long. Rafael Cruz was not living in Dallas at the time. He was definitely living in New Orleans. I mean, we have that documented. And therefore, he must have traveled from New Orleans to Dallas in order to observe the motorcade. Now, that's not a very credible thing to do, because it's one thing to do it if you live in Dallas, but to travel to another state just to get a passing glimpse of the president is really not enough to warrant.
Well, I thought it was very discerning of you, Ralph, to observe that he appears to be standing next to the founder of Alpha 66, Antonio Veciana, right in front of him, who has a very distinctive skull and hair combination, because Alpha 66 was among the most vicious of the anti-Castro organizations involved in assassination, sabotage, bombings.
Murder, right, exactly. Worst of the worst.
The improbability that Rafael Cruz would be in New Orleans with Lee Oswald handing out pamphlets in front of the trademark and later show up in Dallas during the motorcade on 22 November 1963 and not be involved with the CIA, not be on the fringe of the conspiracy to assassinate the president, is virtually infinitesimal.
Hey, Jim, don't forget.
I agree with that. It's mathematically literally impossible. Let me make a quick comment about the collage that we looked at before that compared the figure from the trademark with a known image of Rafael Cruz. I want to comment about the source of the other image of Rafael Cruz. That is supposed
to be. Go back to slide number three, please, Jan. Slide three.
All right. Okay. On the right, that image of him was taken from a promotional video of Ted Cruz, in which he was talking about his father having to escape from Cuba because of the oppression there and the tyranny. And there's a few things he didn't say. The implication, I think, of 99% of people watching it probably assumed that he was talking about Castro. But no, Cruz did not run away from Castro. He was oppressed and he was tortured and mistreated by our man in Cuba, you know, whose name was Batista, Fulgencio Batista. Right. We actually brought him out of retirement to go back to Cuba to run it like our little fiefdom. And then eventually, of course, he was overthrown by Castro. But at the time that Cruz left Cuba, he was only 17 years old, and he never went back. Now, you can look at this man, and you can see he's obviously a lot older than 17. I mean, to my eyes, he looks like he's probably more like late 20s. And the image that's behind him in the larger picture, which has been cropped here, it kind of looks very, very barren, and it has a kind of a primitive look. And I think the implication was that it was Cuba, but it could not possibly have been Cuba. He wasn't in Cuba when he was this age. It must have been taken here somewhere, I presume. But in other words, what I'm saying is he basically lied in the picture and made it sound that, like, this was Rafael Cruz when he departed Cuba, and that was not.
Let me make one point before. Well, Chance switches the slide set, which is this: that on the opposite side of the street, on the corner of Houston, Main and Houston, there was a group of officials from the CIA who were paying their last respects. There's a whole website entitled "Familiar Faces in Dealey Plaza" that inventories how many assassins and mercenaries and so forth, but also CIA officials were in Dealey Plaza at the time.
Well, Jim, let me add to that, Jim, that once the limo rounded the corner on Houston, which was just a half a block from this image, there were other CIA people, and apparently included E. Howard Hunt. There was another one whose name was, it begins with a C. What is it? Lucien?
Lucien Cornet.
Lucien what?
Cornet.
Yeah, Conan. That's right. I'm convinced that that was him there, the Lucian. They've tried to say that some postal worker, but no.
The claim that it was Robert Adams is simply absurd. Jack White blew that out of the air. Chance is working on getting the slide update, by the way. But I want Larry to take over from this point on because he prepared the slide set and got it. Here we go. This is a transition. Larry, take over at this point in time.
No, this is the famous Walter Sisko photograph, one of the most detailed photographs that we find of the JFK limousine. And this was coming down Main Street. Yes. And like you mentioned, Jim, you know, you've used it for the cover of your book and other authors have also used this image extensively. And it was only a couple of weeks ago that Ralph noticed, you know, scanning through the crowd there on the, I believe that would be the south curb of Main Street, that the gentleman, you know, that he's pointed out that we've been talking about, that now he's going to present more slides with more comparisons with different photographs of Rafael Cruz throughout his life, you know. So I'm just going to, you know, let Ralph take over.
If anyone's in doubt, it's right there. There's a black couple. There's a black woman about the third in from the right. Right behind her to the right is Rafael Cruz, and right to her, above her to the left is Antonio Veciana. This is really stunning stuff, Ralph. It was a brilliant of you to make this.
Thank you, Jim. You know, one of the things I want to point out as we begin to analyze this is that throughout his life, Rafael Cruz always seemed to wear these heavy glasses, these heavy frame glasses. And you're going to notice in all the images that we're using here to compare that he has such glasses on, and you'll see, obviously he's wearing them here in this picture. And I think that especially for such a young man, it's a little bit unusual for an event like this, you know, to be wearing such glasses. I think it was his habit. Obviously he needed to wear them, but it represents, I think, a strong, matching, feature that is present in all of the photos.
Yeah, now, it was his habit to wear.
Let's go to the next photo and the next slide. Yes, okay. This is what I call the wedding photo. That is Rafael Cruz, and supposedly that's his wedding to Elizabeth Darby or whatever her name was. What's interesting about this photo is that it has been confirmed that they did not actually legally marry at this time.
They're having some kind of
ceremony here, wearing a rose, but they don't actually marry.
Was she the mother of Ted Cruz, Ralph?
Excuse me? Yeah, that is the mother of Ted Cruz right there. Yeah. That absolutely is. There's no doubt about it. It was the late 60s. Now, you'll notice the very, very good match between the facial features of each of them going from left to right. You notice the heavy glasses. He obviously experienced some hair recession, and he, of course, eventually lost most all of his hair. He's another case of a rapidly balding young man, as we spoke of Lovelady. But if you look at all the features here, and I've looked at them, dividing them up into chin, mouth, lips, nose, eyes, that there is excellent correlation here for everything. And there's nothing that I call a deal breaker. I like to use that term because we're talking here about DNA, a person's individual DNA. And even if two people looked a lot in many respects, if they're not related, if they have different DNA, there's a very good chance that at least in some respects or one respect that they're going to look strikingly different. But nothing is out of place here. There's nothing that screams at us that they're different men. This is, I consider this a very high level correlation.
Go forward with the slides. Yeah.
Go forward. All right. So here we have another one again, you know, and he's in this photo on the right, he's holding baby Ted. So he's holding his son there. And again, we're seeing very similar almond-shaped eyes, almost Asian-looking slightly. And again, he's got the hair recession because he was the rapidly balding young man. The ears match very well. The shape of the face matches very well. The chin matches very well. And even the tendency to keep the mouth open while he's posing for the picture, all those things, you know, match very well. And again, I consider this to be a very high correlation image.
Very good. I like the points you're making.
All right, let's go to the next one. All right, so here obviously we have the modern older Cruz. And again, the correlation is very good. I'll point out a few things. Obviously, his hair is mostly gone now because he's old. His nose looks actually kind of bigger and puffier on the right, but keep in mind that your ears and your nose keep growing throughout life. That is a known fact in medicine. The cartilage just keeps growing. Look what happened to W.C. Fields. And so the fact that his nose seems a little bit more lumpen on the right is only because he got older, and that is what happens. But the mouth, the chin, the shape of the face, and the eyes, again, excellent here. This is, I've been doing photo comparison now for 5 years, and I consider this to be first class. I've never seen anything better.
You've gotten very good at it, Ralph.
Okay, let's go to the next. Okay, now in this one, in the lower right, you're seeing Ted there. I can only guess about how old he was, probably about 4. And that would make the age of the picture 1974, so it would have been 11 years after. Notice again that he's wearing those heavy glasses again. Now, I think I want to point out here that I would say most people have the tendency, if they're going to take a family photo, to take their glasses off for the picture. Even if they wear glasses most of the time or even all of the time, they will take their glasses off for the picture. And what I'm wondering about this is if to some extent he wore glasses as a disguise, if he just liked the fact that it kind of maybe framed his face a little differently and just really had this strong, strong tendency to feel safer, you know, wearing these glasses. But otherwise, again, I think the correlation, eyes, nose, mouth, chin, shape of the face, very, very good. Very first rate for that to be him.
Next.
Let's go to the next one. Okay, we didn't do this one. All right, yes, this one, I call this the man from space because those glasses on the right are almost over the top, the extent to which they are just totally, you might say,
theatrical.
Obfuscating. I mean, who wears glasses like that, especially for a photograph? Again, to me, this is paranoia.
But he's hiding. He's hiding.
He's hiding his face behind those big glasses. And notice how he's constantly changing his facial hair. Sometimes clean shaven, sometimes a mustache, sometimes a mustache and a goatee. Changing it up, mixing it up, constantly trying to, you know, keep his looks, obscured. But again, this works out perfectly at the rate that he was balding, that his hair would have receded that much. And the correlation of the ears, the nose, the mouth, shape of the face, the length of the neck, all of it is very good. Very first class. Let's go to the next. Well, we did. This is another one. Again, we've got the heavy glasses, big rims, top and bottom, big wide arms to the glass. And again, I want to point out what I like about this collage is how perfectly the smiles match. He had a very relaxed, open mouth smile, and you see it in several of his pictures. Some people have more of a tense smile where they just don't really know how to smile naturally, and but in this case, the smile matches very well. The nose matches very, very well. And he had sort of what I call slit-like eyes where, they weren't big and round. They were more kind of wide and narrow. And you're getting the same impression, on both sides. And again, I think that this is another very, very good correlation. The ears match very well. This photo was probably from the mid-70s somewhere. Well, again, probably 74 or 75, but that is a very good match to him. Let's go on. Now, this was more of a close-up of the face. You know, I made this one because I really wanted to get the heart of the face. And what I like about it is it shows a very good correlation with the distance between the eyes and just the general configuration of the nose and the mouth and
relative relation of the ears, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the teeth.
It's all very constant. It's all very uniform. And again, I find it to be just non-believable that that could just be by accident, be somebody else who just happened to be there. And then think again about where he is. We're talking about being at the motorcade of JFK motorcade moments before JFK was going to get slaughtered. I mean, if we found a matching photo to him from anywhere, say from Times Square or from Miami Beach, it would be unusual. But to actually find it in Dealey at the entrance to Dealey Plaza, no. Coincidences like that, I do not respect. No way. Right.
We've been using the term interpupillary distance since October, Ralph.
That's a good interpupillary distance. Well, that's what matches very
every
well.
Every time that we've been talking about the overlays and Doorman and Lee Oswald and Billy Lovely.
Now, this collage is actually one of my favorites because it's the one that correlates to him when he was younger. And
that's the Matanzas. That's called the Matanzas photo book.
That's right. That's from when he was, I guess, it was a school photo from when he was going to school in Cuba.
Yeah.
But what really strikes me here, and this is where if you had a plastic surgeon or maybe even just a pediatrician who really understands the maturation of a face, that what we're seeing here is just a perfect expectation of how that very young face, that teenage face on the left, would mature by the time he was, in his early 20s, as we're seeing on the right. I mean, that is really, really good. In fact, even though we're seeing he's wearing those glasses on the right, we're still getting a sense that the eyebrows over the eyes are perfectly correlated with what we see on the left. The ears are perfectly correlated. There is really just another feature that I've noticed in several of the pictures is that he happens to have a fuller lower lip and a thinner upper lip. And, you know, people are very different that way. You know, there's all kinds of combinations that people have, but he happened to have a prominent full lower lip and a thinner upper lip, and Oswald was that way too, for instance. But we're seeing it on both of them. So again, the odds that this is somebody else who just happened to be there and look that much like him is just infinitesimal. Mathematically, to me, it's just so small that it's virtually non-existent.
Number 10.
All right, here again. This is that photo again that was taken in, that was displayed in the Ted Cruz video, which described him fleeing, you know, Cuba because of the oppression. And obviously that is not what the photo was. So that aspect of it was a lie. To me, this correlation is very well because what we're seeing here is the deep dark eyes, and we're seeing the nose, and the only thing that doesn't correlate very well is the dimension of the top of the head. We're getting more of a sense of a very, very slender head on the right. But let me tell you something, and this is just a suspicion. I'm not changing it for a fact. I'm not stating it as a fact. But I actually seriously suspect that photo was manipulated with the aspect ratio in order to make his face look more horse-like than it was.
You're not alone. That had crossed my mind too, Ralph, in looking at various of these photos.
Because I don't think that his face is ever that long in there.
Across the forehead.
Yeah, it does look fake. It almost looks like he has a toupee on.
Yeah. So, again, I think that they may have manipulated that photo, but again, I'll point out, again with the glasses, and here, of course, it looks like he's wearing sunglasses, but Rafael Cruz has been hiding behind the disguise of his glasses for a long time, and he was doing it in Dealey Plaza.
Well, I just wanted to say that this photograph is taken from a video clip very short 11-second video clip that was that's published on YouTube, and we have talked about this this particular portion of this sequence because we have noted that Chauncey Holt is in the photograph, and in the foreground, two gentlemen that are walking in front of the camera, we have already seen that their faces have been obfuscated. Okay, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that the area where Rafael Cruz is shown in this sequence might have also been tampered with.
Right, true, very true. Go ahead. Next.
Yeah, next.
You know what's interesting about this photo is that just because it's an isolated photo, that I want you to notice that the shape of his face now, his head looks different. It's not so long and narrow anymore. Do you notice how now it looks more normal? It sort of looks like, in other words, what I'm saying is that if we could take this exact photo without altering it and put it next to the one in the trademark, I think it would really jump out at us now because you don't have that long Mr. Ed horse-like face that's so narrow. It looks more, it looks like the aspect ratio has kind of been normalized. So, again, I really tip my hat to Wayne Mattson for finding that. I think it's very, very compelling. And you can even see here that he's getting the beginning of the widow's peak. It's, his hairline is starting to go back and it was going to accelerate. And, so that's just the way it went for him with his hair, but we can see it later in the other photos. Go ahead. All right, now this is the photo that Jim mentioned. On the left, we have this Antonio Vesiana. And on the right, we're having this man who seems to be in the company of Rafael Cruz. And I have some other ones. I don't know if I sent them or not, but they also look pretty good as far as, you know, the eyes, the nose, the mouth. And
I think this was a brilliant find, Ralph.
Yeah, and I like I said, I am really convinced that that there's just a very good probability that that is him. And as Larry told me the other day, we know for a fact that there were many Cuban dissidents in the motorcade. And Larry, isn't it true that you said that some of them were even holding up anti-JFK signs?
Oh yeah, well, that's what we're going to talk about now to close the show. The way that these Cuban exiles were actually stalking JFK, you know, from one city to the next. Okay, and that's why our next slide is it's one that's going to just blow your minds out away because it talks about a letter that was received by the Miami police. And this was right at the time when JFK was supposed to speak in Miami, where apparently there was supposed to be a motorcade and it was canceled at the last minute, and they transported him by helicopter or something like that. But this letter was received. This is a very rare letter, you know. This is dated, the postmark, November 19, 1963, the weekend before when he was in Miami. And what it talks about, it's dated November 16, it's anonymous, obviously, and it talks about the Cuban commandos have the bombs ready for killing JFK and Mayor King high, either at the airport or at the convention hall. A Catholic padre is going to give instructions at the Cuban women's broadcast at 8:45 tonight on Radio Reloj. And then all are invited to dance at Bayfront Park Auditorium and take Bayfront Park Auditorium and take along a bottle of wine, whiskey, etc. to decide who will throw the bombs at King High, because he did sign the ordinance about taxi drivers being only American citizens and sending refugees away, etc. Mary, okay. Now, this is pretty overt here, you know, where they're talking about bombing JFK, you know, in Miami, you know, and then as far as the stalking is concerned, if we go on to the next slide, we all know about dark complected man, okay, who was sitting there, he was standing right next to Umbrella Man, and it's been narrowed down to two different people, either Felipe Vidal or Orlando Bosch. Okay, so everybody's got their different opinion on who that gentleman might have been, because he was obviously giving signs there at the curb to the shooters or whoever had was in charge of the coordinated ambush there that JFK was.
I believe it was Felipe Vidal Santiago, and that his nose has been slightly altered in some of the photographs.
Right. So this particular spread here was published in Dateline Dallas in the early 90s. And if you look closely, Jack White prepared this. And if you look at this guy had been actually stalking JFK. If you look at the bottom right, and I'm going to show close-ups of this guy in the next couple of slides, he's shown there at Love Airfield, okay, in the crowd there. And he's on the tarmac, Jim, okay? So this guy...
I've never seen this stuff, Larry. Fascinating.
Okay, well, you know, hold on to your seats here, because later on at Parkland, this guy is photographed at Parkland Hospital wearing a couple of cameras, like he's, you know, playing the photographer type of thing, and he's there, casually looking at the crowd, you know, they're standing there at one of the limos, okay? And so Jack White made the comparison with the man at the on Elm Street, you know, a dark complected man, as we have known name this guy, and it's apparently the same guy. If you go on to the next slide, and I'm going to show you a close up of the photograph. This is the one at Love Field, and the red circle. You can see the beret, you know, the type of Che Guevara beret, who I think this might have been also making some kind of a statement here, you know. But he's there at Love Field. And like I said, you know, this guy is you know, he's got some kind of really good connections, because what is he doing there right there on the tarmac, you know, right at Love Field. Okay, so the next slide shows obviously a dark complected man, you know, after the shooting where he's sitting there. Right there where he's this is from the Grant photograph, and he's sitting there, and apparently this is the same guy, you know. You know, he's got everything, you know, the beret, the glasses, the jacket, the white jacket, you know. And so the next slide, and this is the one at Parkland, and this is the same guy, you know, right there in the foreground. You can see him, you know, looking towards the crowd and, you know, taking in, you know, the scene there at Parkland Hospital. So
disturbing, Larry.
this guy was stalking. He was there, you know. So this goes follows, you know, what we were just talking about, that these Cubans had been stalking and following JFK from city to city, and now after the deed is done, they all went squirreling, you know, their own different ways, you know, hiding, you know, the way Rafael Cruz went and hid in Calgary, you know, after the fact. Okay, so you know, I just wanted to show these, you know, and the next slide is from the actual article, and it talks about a little bit about, you know, the Umbrella Man, the Cuban, you know, have been a curious mystery to researchers of the assassination for years. Jack White of Fort Worth created a display. That's what we were just talking about. And so I was wondering if, had you ever heard about this, Jim? I mean, this whole thing with this Cuban, you know, the way that I presented
him. No, not that he was at Love Field, not that he was at the motorcade, and
in Parkland,
was sitting on the steps beside the Umbrella Man, who were the only two who weren't acting like had no idea what was going on. They're the most calm, collected, just simply sit down and relax, like
Right. Everything's
happening according to plan.
And, you know, he had a radio transmitter, walkie-talkie, in his back pocket, by the way, because we've seen photographs of him, you know, taken from behind, you know, and where he was part of the coordination, you know, of gunfire there at Dealey Plaza that day. And then, you know, apparently he had the connections, like I said, because he was at every relevant place. You know, the only place I don't think he ever was at the Tippit shooting. But, you know, who knows? Maybe he was there, too.
Well, it's pretty bizarre any way you cut it.
Yeah.
You know, Jim, I know we don't have much time left, but let me just refer back, if you don't mind, to something you said earlier about, we were talking about the Lucy and Conan figure and about how they've been trying to say that it was a guy named Robert Adams, the postal worker. Well, I found images of him, and it turns out that his whole face was looked nothing like that other guy. In what I said before, they actually used photography to change the aspect ratio, where they just reshaped his face.
Conan had a rounder face. He had a more oval face. There were several other features. Jack White nailed this.
Decades ago. And I'll tell you something else. They messed with his eyes. They made his eyes look darker, like the figure. So it's a complete photographic sham when they tried to say that. And, of course, we know that it's typical. We know that the JFK assassination is the most photographically altered event there ever was, that they altered everything they could get their hands on. But, you know, this idea of, you know, messing with that, is something that they do. They do it now. They did it then. And I really think that, in that one photo of Rafael Cruz, that they deliberately narrowed his face just to create distance and departure from the other figure. That's why I sincerely believe that.
No, yes. And then for the unwary, they present the altered photograph and say, how could anyone become so confused and think these were the photographs of the same person?
Right.
Well, this is the final slide. You know, I just wanted to make a quick comment on what the Cuban exile community thinks about Man in the Doorway. And the actual name of the file, I found this at one of the exile websites, you know, where they have a lot of pictures and photographs. And to the right, it says LHO-TSBD, 1963, November, and the name of the file.
I've identified him as Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, exactly.
Ralph, I want you to take this opportunity just to talk about this image, since you've done so much on it. I think your work has been just...
Thank you very much, Jim. You know, the way I feel about it is that in this day and age, with all the work that we've done, and, you know, speaking for myself and Larry and Dennis, that it's just complete denialism to say that isn't Oswald. I mean, we have a perfect match of not only the man, but the clothing. I mean, it is so mathematically expansive when you
That's Lee, Ralph, but that beside him holding his hands up to shade his eyes is Billy Lovelady. I mean, Billy said he thought it was...
That is Billy Lovelady, who is visoring his eyes with his hand. And keep in mind that there's nothing photographically legitimate about his entire face being blackened. In fact, let's think about this humorously for a moment. There was so much light streaming into this man's face, blinding his eyes, that he had to bring his hands up in order to block some of the light.
Right.
And yet we're supposed to believe that the result was that his entire face was blackened out.
Right. And you proved it, Ralph, with your reenactment.
The reenactment proved it as well. But
remember how Billy said that he thought it was odd they'd be confused because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter than Lee and 15 to 20 pounds heavier, exactly as we see of this person in relation to Lee Oswald. And, of course, he's wearing the short-sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. He took to the FBI when they asked him to come in wearing the shirt he'd been wearing during the motorcade.
Now, what I'm thinking is that they did something to remove the stripes from the shirt.
Absolutely.
Looks, you know, gleaming white. Yeah. But I think that was very easily done. They had no problem doing it. In fact, you know, here's what I really think. Remember how small this was in the entire Alchin's photo. When they whited out his striped shirt, and then they, of course, put the white obfuscation over the face of obfuscated man, the result was that from a distance, if you were looking at the whole photo, that it basically just looked like that was all of him. In other words, all you're seeing is the white, and it looks like it's his shirt, and you really don't see obfuscated man at all. We only really can pick him out in these enlarged crops. But in the entire photo, he sort of disappears. And that was the whole idea. Larry, who is it that you think obfuscated man was?
Oh, that's Otis Williams.
Otis Williams.
Yeah, they're very short, pudgy, very pudgy man. You know, and you can see the gut and everything. And I have to credit, because you got to give credit where credit is due. The people that did the Prayer Man video, you know, really steered me to change my assessment. I had thought that was Joe Molina. You know, and a lot of times you just have to admit, you know, when you're wrong. I was wrong.
Okay.
And it's very obvious to me because of the how short he was. You know, I later on, you know, Sloan's book, you know, about the witnesses, he's got very good pictures in there, and of Otis Williams, and they match perfectly, you know. So
let me say this, Jim, if we have time, that, you know, lately, I've had a strong focus on the idea, as radical as it sounds, that the whole book distributing business at the book depository was just a front, a complete sham. I'm convinced of it now. I've suspected it before, but I'm completely convinced of it.
Well, you're making excellent points about it. I mean, it's so disorganized. You just have these boxes. If these were actually books, you'd have to know what books were in the boxes. They'd have to be
The whole thing is ridiculous. There's
shelves. They'd have to be very easily identified.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we don't have anything legible in those boxes. You know, there was a guy named Troy West. He was an African-American man, a slender, kind of a little guy. And supposedly, he was the whole shipping department. So you had all these order fillers who were gathering up books, bringing them to him. And do you know what he called himself? He called himself the mail wrapper. He didn't say he was the shipper. He said, I wrap the mail. And he said that he would wrap it in paper. He would wrap these loose books in paper, and then he would tape it up and put a string on it. In other words, he would do it the way grandma would send a fruitcake at Christmas time. And this was for a big company that had 75 employees, all these clerical workers. They had a whole second floor that was full of people at desks doing stuff. And yet you had one shipper who could handle the whole load. And apparently he never shipped a whole box of books. I mean, here their customers were supposedly schools, not individuals, not families, but schools. Schools ordering textbooks for classes, and yet it was all small bundles, a few books, wrap it up, tape it up, you know, string it up, and they never actually shipped a whole book. I mean, a whole box of books. So again, I think the whole thing about the book distributing was a ruse. But the reason why I thought of it is because we were talking about Joe Molina. And, you know, Joe Molina was very active in this GI Forum, which was supposed to be like a kind of a rights organization for Hispanic veterans.
That's right.
And I have to wonder if really what he was doing was just infiltrating, and, you know, because they were, you know, they were wanting to determine if there were any leftist, communist elements, you know, in these various.
That was with a shoe salesman, undercover agent by the name of Bill Lowry, and he had infiltrated the Communist Party in that area. And the connection with Joe is obvious, okay, where they were both infiltrating, you know, the Communist Party in one way or another. And then later on, he was subpoenaed and he had to, you know, tell it the way it was, that he was an agent, you know, and he was very good friends with Joe Molina. So that's why there's always been that suspicion about him.
Now, isn't it true that Joe Molina was supposed to have been in the doorway?
That's right. Where
do you think he was, and why don't we see
him? I have him pegged as black tie man. He, Shirley Martin went to see him. And she asked him where he was and she showed him the Alton's photograph, and he pointed at black tie man right behind Lee Oswald, and he said that was him.
That might be Joe Molina. Well, I know that when asked, Joe Molina refused to say who he recalled was in the doorway.
Well, Ralph, Larry, look, remember, black tie man has to be an insertion because he's overlapping Lee Oswald's left shoulder.
I believe that very strongly, but it's possible that they got him from somewhere else and sort of snuck him in there. I mean, it might have been that he was elsewhere.
I'd be dumbfounded if that's Joe Molina. That appears to me to be a transfer of an image, probably from the left here.
Well, you know, the problem is that it's so crude. It is
He identified himself to Shirley Martin. I have the documents that show.
Oh, but wait a second, Larry. Are you saying that he identified himself as that figure?
That's right.
I would very much like to see that.
I'll send it to you. I have the document.
Right. Larry, do we have photographs of Joe Molina? Does he look anything like Black Diamond?
Yes, I do. There's only one photograph that came out for the 25th observance in the Dallas Morning News. I have that. It's a very good photograph, but you can't really make any comparison because you can't see anything.
No, it's a photographically inadequate image. But while we're talking about these things, I also want to reiterate my opinion, which I've had for many years now, that the figure in the fedora hat on our left is very likely Jack Ruby. I am still convinced. Again, I'm not going to say I'd bet my life on it.
I thought you stated by the hat on the little boy, right?
Well, the thing I noticed about this picture that most people probably wouldn't notice is that I am from the mechanics of his angle, I am convinced that we're actually looking at the back of him and that we're seeing the back of his hat and that he's actually facing Oswald and looking at Oswald, which is why they had to cover it up. But I don't believe that he's you see, if you look above, and it's not easy to see, but if you look above the wool hat of the boy, and keep in mind that at that time in Dealey Plaza, it was either 70 degrees or hotter. It was a warm, at that moment, it was a warm, sunny situation.
Right. The wool hat doesn't make any sense.
The hat does not make any sense.
The morning started cold and drizzly.
Right. It was cold and drizzly. But you know something? He would have removed his hat by this point. Little kids are like biological furnaces. They have such good circulation that the heat gets everywhere. He would have been very uncomfortable at 70 degrees. To have a wool hat on, not just on, but pulled down over his ears. But the thing I wanted to say is that if you look above his wool cap, you see what looks like a kind of like a bronzed area before it gets to the black rim of the hat. And in fact, one person suggested that it's the forehead and that it was a black-skinned man, that like maybe he was African-American. But I don't think so. I think that that's the ribbon of his hat, and he's facing the other way. He's actually, so we're seeing his back. We're seeing the back of his hat. He's facing Oswald, and that's why they had to cover that up. But let's remember something, that Jack Ruby was everywhere. He was at Parkland. He was at the homicide division when Oswald was led there after his arrest. He was at the midnight press conference. He was in the hallway when Curry was being interviewed and even corrected Curry. Curry said something, he didn't say fair play for Cuba committee right. He gave a different term for it. And Jack Ruby corrected him. Do you know that? That when Jesse Curry was being interviewed by a reporter, that Jack Ruby corrected him and said, no,
fair play
for Cuba committee.
Yeah.
All right, so Jack Ruby's everywhere.
He mistakenly said it was the Free Cuba Committee. Yeah. Ralph, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely sensational. Larry, Gary. Gary, you can take us out with a closing remark, but I'm really grateful to Ralph for his contributions tonight. Thank you so very much.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we very much had the best of the best when it comes to Lee in the Doorway. You have Ralph Sinkay. You've got Larry Rivera, who's number one in the new JFK research. We've got the granddaddy of them all, Jim Fetzer. We've got Chance George in engineer's chair, so how can you go wrong? We'll see you next week. We've got a great show lined up for you.
Thank you, Gary. Good night, everybody. Thank you.